This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
In this lecture, Martina Steber talks about a very English superstar, John Rutter, popular classical music and transnational conservatism since the 1970s. It has gone largely unnoticed by musicologists and historians that the British composer, conductor, and music entrepreneur John Rutter has become a leading figure in popular music since the 1980s. Successful on the global music market, popular in the English-speaking world, and regularly topping the classical music charts with his Christmas carol compositions, Rutter embodies the opposite of commercial pop culture. He is the anti-type of a pop star. He succeeds with sacred music, he addresses the middle class, and he personifies family values, community spirit, and the preservation of tradition. Using the example of Rutter, the lecture will demonstrate the importance of conservative pop cultures for the emergence and development of transnational conservatism in Europe and North America since the 1970s. Martina Steber has been deputy head of the Munich Research Department of the Leibniz Institute for Contemporary History, IFZ, since 2017. She was previously a research fellow at the German Historical Institute London from 2007 to 2012, a fellow of the Historisches Kolleg in Munich in 2012 and 13, a research fellow at the IFZ, and deputy professor at the universities of Augsburg, Konstanz, and Wuppertal, in 2016 to 2018 and 2020. Her research focuses on modern German and British history, especially the history of the Nazi regime, conservatism and regional history.
It is a tremendous pleasure to be back in this room and at this institute, which still feels a bit of a home, sort of a far, far away home, and I'm always very happy to return. He was writing about a very English superstar. The Australian journalist Nick Garvin informed his readers when he portrayed the British composer, conductor and producer John Rutter in the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper in 2019. Bald-headed, spectacled, wearing a classical shirt, Rutter rather was looking like an English village priest than the celebrated global star of classical music that he actually was, Gavin Holt. In the field of sacred choral music, Rutter was considered to be, quote, the world's greatest living composer. And indeed, Gavin could assume that John Rutter was well known to the Australian public. From the 1970s, his Christmas carols had entered the musical repertoire of Anglo-American Christmas culture. Choral music was indeed integral to the celebration of Christmas in the Anglo-Saxon world in the form of the social practices of singing in the choir and of attending choir concerts, which figured as key social events in local societies. But choral Christmas songs, that is, Christmas carols, were also a product of the global music industry to be merchandised and capitalised on huge profit margins. Since the 1990s, John Rutter has been dominating this global market, and every year anew he competes with pop icons about sale figures and music chart positions. Comparably successful are Rutter's other mainly sacred compositions in the world of church music on international concert stages and in the commercial music business. In Rutter, conservatism, classical music, and the global culture industries meet. He is a figure of pop culture, even if an unnoticed one. His music and the social practice that connect with his music not only contradict the usual understanding of modern pop culture, even more, they are fundamentally opposed to it. Rutter impersonates the absolute counter image of a pop star. He succeeds with classical sacred music, he fills churches and concert halls, he addresses the middle class, he personifies family values, community spirit, and reverence for tradition. His example provides, therefore, access to the conservative side of pop culture, which, exactly because it is so counterintuitive, has not been noticed by historical research so far. Not by chance, the superstar of sacred choral music is a British musician. Since the 18th century, the UK was marked by a high permeability of high-end popular culture. After the mid-20th century, as former imperial metropole, and because of the global dominance of the English language, the country developed into a global hub of pop culture. At the same time, the UK was instrumental in the restructuring of political conservatism in Europe and Northern America, which took place simultaneously. The rise of John Rutter to the improbable superstar he is neatly tied to these wider processes. Hence, at the example of John Rutter and his contribution to popular classical music, we can scrutinize transnational cultures of conservatism from the 1970s. That's what I'm going to elaborate on today. What were their characteristics? What made them conservative? And how can we perceive of conservatism in the cultural realm? First, I will introduce you to the field and think about the leading concepts. Then I will present John Rutter as a composer, conductor, and musical entrepreneur by focusing on his Christmas music. In this way, we will be able to get an idea of the multifaceted cultures of conservatism which had formed around Rutter and his music. I will conclude with some reflections on conservatism and pop culture. And after that, I look forward to our discussion. Very rarely, historical research has inquired after the conservative potentials of popular music culture. This is true for contemporary history and for modern history alike. So what I would like to present today is more than a project on the history of our times or the history of the present, as it is known. Rather, I aim for a wider understanding of a culture history of conservatism from the mid-19th century onwards. From the beginnings, modern political conservatism had a cultural side, and that side has been overwhelmingly been neglected by research so far. Only if we take conservatism as a cultural phenomenon seriously, we can evaluate the social impact of conservative thought and politics. Popular classical music, as represented by John Rutter, shows some essential features of pop culture, which arguably is one of the distinct characteristics of the late 20th and the early 21st centuries. A consistent commercialization by the music industry, the dissolution of any borders between serious and popular music, transnationality, and a multi-directional mode of consumption. Pop culture was based on burgeoning demand and international market-based culture industries that further commercialized music and turned it into a multi-billion dollar business. All areas of music cultures were swept away by these dynamics, classical music included. The musical industries of the US and the UK were pace setters in this respect. In the history of conservatism, British and American forces also increasingly gained influence in the Western industrial states. The national political conservatisms of the individual countries transformed considerably in this course. Liberal and secular ideas entered conservative reasoning and manifested in a change of economic and social thought in conservatism. The new conservatism was socially and culturally furthered by the transformation of established class structures and the formation of new middle-class life worlds, the recoding of religious worldviews, the challenge to traditional values, and the fragmentation of bourgeois culture practices. These cultural transformations were pushed forward by pluralization and individualization processes, which left a heavy mark on the new conservatisms of the late 20th century. Conservative culture critics first commented rather critically on the triumph of mass entertainment culture. Their voices, however, were increasingly pushed aside. The Anglo-American new conservatism of the 80s pretty much embraced pop culture, and it was not by chance that the former Hollywood actor Ronald Reagan presided over a conservative government in the US. It would, however, be wrong to describe the relationship between political conservatism and pop culture as a simple equation between parties and sympathetic artists. Around popular music, mediated by listening to and experiencing individual artists, bands, or orchestras, or by making music in lay formations of any sorts, cultures formed that were apt to support conservative ways of making sense to the world. Conservative lifestyles too manifested in the cultural practices of listening to music, experiencing music, and making music. This was hardly a new phenomenon, but one of bourgeois modernity. What was new was the turn towards transnational pop culture and the multitude of options to choose from that were offered by an expanding music industry and the pluralization of styles. The conservative politicization of music therefore took shape in many nuances. One of them was to label music culture as genuinely unpolitical. In conservative thought, the restriction of politics to state affairs corresponded to the definition of culture as a space far apart from politics, in which conservatism could be cultivated as an unpolitical lifestyle. In the UK, Michael Oakeshott famously advanced exactly this idea of conservatism in his often quoted essay on being conservative in the 1960s. In approaching cultures of conservatism in most recent history, we therefore need a concept of conservatism that includes these paradoxical political and political forms rooted in everyday life. They surely could be politicized for conservative politics if certain themes or sentiments were explicitly connected to political projects or programs. In most cases, however, this did not happen. John Rutter too assiduously avoided any political positioning. Yet this did not mean that no cultures of conservatism would have formed around him and his music. Quite the opposite was the case. John Rutter, born in 1945, is the star of the British choir scene. From the 70s onwards, it has been hard to imagine the genre of popular classical music without him. Rutter's music is played on all radio stations dedicated to classical music, first of all on Classic FM and meanwhile also on BBC Radio 3. He composes and arranges music, he conducts, he manages his own choir, the Cambridge Singers, and he has his own record label. His compositions are published by Oxford University Press, as well as his choir books that very much define the core repertoire in the UK. Apart from that, Rutter organizes big choral events, sing-along concerts and workshops in which he rehearses his own compositions, stand beside opulent performances in the Royal Albert Hall in London or the Carnegie Hall in New York. Since the 1980s, John Rutter is almost as popular in the US as he is in the UK. generally, his music is internationally successful, listened to and played in Europe as well in Australia, Canada, Brazil, Japan, or South Africa. Beginning in the 1990s, Rutter's compositions also entered the German choir repertoire. The Sizilienverband der deutschsprachigen Länder, that is the German Association of Catholic Church Musicians, awarded him with his Orlando Lasso Medaille in 2013, and in 2019, the city of Schwäbisch Gmünd honored him with his Prize of European Church Music. John Rutter combines all dimensions of the culture industrial music market in one person. From the composition and the arrangement to the staging, the recording, the distribution, and the marketing of music. The economic opportunities of the transatlantic music market were the decisive factor for him to quit his position as director of music at Clare College, Cambridge in 1979. John Rutter became a successful entrepreneur. Even more, he created a brand of himself. Without any reservations, he pushed the commercialization of his music forward, integrating it into the consumer culture of the US and the UK. He profited from the professionalization and commercialization of classical music in general and sacred music in particular that took place in Europe and the US from the 60s. The use of What Sweeter Music, one of his most popular carols for a TV commercial of the Swedish car manufacturer Volvo, produced for the American market in 1993, testifies to this. Hundreds of thousands of copies of his CDs and his sheet music have been sold. His CD productions are regularly riding high in the sales charts of classical music. Rutter indeed serves a global market. While in Germany and in other continental European countries, the reception of his music is restricted to the field of choral sacred music, it stretches far beyond in the UK and the US. The reasons are twofold. First, performances of his compositions at and commissioned works for key festivities of the British monarchy elevated Rutter virtually into the position of a state composer. During the service for the 100th birthday of the Queen Mother in 2000, one of his compositions was performed. In 2002, he set Psalm 140 to music for Queen Elizabeth's second Golden Jubilee. In 2011, he wrote a hymn for the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton, and also at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, John Rutter's music was played. When the Queen celebrated her Diamond Jubilee in 2012, Rutter produced a CD with music on royal occasions, sung by the Cambridge Singers, conducted by the master himself. Even if at Helmut Kohl's funeral service in Speyer Cathedral in 2017, the Sanctus of Rutter's Requiem was sung in a specially written version for the occasion, this certainly was proof of the appreciation for the composer and German church music, but it did not give him the national significance which is attributed to him in the UK. This holds equally true for the US. For both memorial services held for the victims of the 9/11 attacks in New York in 2001, Rutter's Requiem was chosen. Rutter's music was also present at John McCain's funeral service in 2018. All this underlines the composer's outstanding position in American church music. The appreciation of Rutter far beyond church music circles in the UK and the US is secondly based on his success as a composer of Christmas carols. Apart from his big choir works like the Requiem, composed in 1985, the Gloria, 1974, his Magnificat, 1990, or the Mass of the Children, 2003, his oeuvre mainly consists of carols. Almost anybody can experience Christmas without coming across Rutter, neither in the UK nor in the US. On both sides of the Atlantic, the sound worlds of Rutter's carols are regarded as embodiment of Christmas. But are they conservative? Asked whether he could describe his compositional style, Rutter answered in 2020 briefly and succinctly, eclectic, conservative, accessible, but I hope recognizable as my own. Rutter's music is marked by melody and harmony. It is playful, virtually cheerful, and does not shy away from any effect. It is occasionally described as sentimental, superficial, and cheesy. Rutter, The Times, wrote in 2002, quote, must be marzipan eaten wearing velvet slippers. I brought two examples with me just for you to get an impression. Not only commercial reasons explain Rutter's characteristic style. Even in his very first compositions in the 1960s, he consciously set a counterpoint to the dominating compositional styles in classical music of his time. Rutter insisted on not being part of the avant-garde, which was in search for new means of expression and new soundscapes in order to catch the fragmented present times. Instead, he took his cue from the traditions before the atonal new departures of mid-modernity. He was looking for a style of melodiousness in continuity to the old masters. At the same time, he was influenced by the American musical theater and by film music, especially by the composers Jerome Kern, Richard Rodgers, George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Stephen Sondheim, and Irving Berlin. European tradition and American new beginnings were meant to connect in Rutter's style. The American reference served as a self-conscious anchoring of his music in the popular. Popular music, Rutter wanted to be understood in two ways. On the one side, as art for a wide audience, on the other, as music that was actually popular, music that was played, sung, and listened to. Rutter perceived of himself as an item in a long chain of sacred music culture in the UK, as a representative of the English cathedral tradition. In one of its centers at King's College, Cambridge, he was musically socialized. His compositional frame of reference was Christian and Occidental, and he would himself position within this tradition. This became apparent in many ways, in the use of old liturgical texts and the English language of the King James Bible of 1611 and the Book of Common Prayer of 1662, in musical quotations, in the integration of traditional elements of style like Gregorian chant, but also in his editorial work for OUP, especially the prior book European Sacred Music. This tradition he set against Christian pop and rock music, which quickly gained popularity in many parishes all over the place. Instead, Rutter, very much in a conservative vein, sought to establish a new form of the popular, not in breach with tradition, but in further developing the traditional by integrating contemporary styles of popular music. To himself, Rutter attested the particular quality which he denied to Christian pop music and referred to his education in the center of English church music at the University of Cambridge and its colleges. Already during his time at Highgate School here in London, one of the country's leading public schools, he enjoyed an advanced musical education. The later acclaimed composer of sacred music, John Tabernacle, was one of his schoolmates. In 1963, Rutter went to Clare College, Cambridge to study music and was promoted by David Wilcox, the influential director of music at King's College and conductor of its internationally renowned choir. A PhD project on the split between art music and popular music in the 19th century came to nothing, but it indicates how important this hypothesis was for the young Rutter. In comparison to academic studies, his compositional work became ever more important. After a short spell at the University of Southampton, he became director of music at Clare College, Cambridge in 1975. 1 year later, also fellow of the college. He developed the choir further, which as a mixed choir had contributed a new facet to the English choral landscape, especially at the old universities. Until his decision to give up the secure position at Clare College and to venture into self-employment, Butter remained in the inner circle of Cambridge musical life. There he was educated and his musical understanding was shaped. These connections remain strong until today. Still, John Butter and his family live in a small village not far from the university town. In a very rare musicologist short piece on John Butter, the American musicologist and church musician Paul Westermeyer depicted the composer as a, quote, popular romantic. Butter's music, he argued, transferred its listeners into a sweetened bubble far away from reality, as it would lack any understanding of dissonance, the brokenness, the darkness of the world and the gospel alike. This did not and does not trouble Rutter's fans, and neither does it impinge on his commercial success. Rutter was the Bruce Springsteen of sacred music, a young American organist claimed. His music was popular, and it could be read in a conservative sense. Every year at Christmas, Rutter's popularity curve rises exponentially. When in 2000, the Guardian newspaper described the composer as the musical equivalent of Charles Dickens, his elevation into the pop cultural aristocracy was completed. Rutter is rooted in a musical culture that had decisively shaped the British celebration of Christmas since the First World War and that had evolved around King's College Cambridge, its chapel and its choir. From the beginning of the 20th century, King's College Choir defined the singing style of English cathedral choirs. On the one hand, the chapel's music directors formed a specific choral sound which blended into the English cathedral tradition, was considered to be particularly English, and which other choirs adopted as a model. Due to the professional marketing of the choir, its CD production and global concert tours, this particular sound was widely disseminated. Not least, the BBC turned King's College Choir into a national symbol. On the other hand, the style-shaping impact of the Cambridge College Choir was due to the form of the Christmas service that was annually broadcast on the 24th of December by the BBC on national radio since 1928 and on the International Imperial Service since 1932. In 1938, the Mutual Broadcasting System of America joined into the transmission, and also in some European countries, people could listen to the service on the radio. American stations adopted the program again beginning in 1979. With the BBC broadcasts, later also on television, the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols became an essential part of middle-class Christmas celebrations in the UK and the countries of the Empire alike. In this way, the festival blended in the British imperial and post-imperial culture of Christmas in the 20th century. A Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols is a sequence of lectures from the Bible as well as of Christmas carols, which as a liturgical form first had been introduced to King's College Chapel by chaplain Eric Milner White at Christmas 1918. Milner White sought to capture the disillusionment, bitterness, and loss of Christian faith that he encountered in many men after the experience of the First World War in a reformed liturgy, which was supposed to create an aesthetic as well as an emotional experience of faith. At the same time, the liturgy was defined by a clear-cut hierarchy, both theologically and the succession of lessons from the Old to the New Testament, and socially as the order of readers for the lessons mirrored the church hierarchy. After some rearrangements in the following year, this liturgical form of service was established as a model that is followed by to the present day. The Second World War endowed the service with national meaning. It connected front and home front all over the empire in the Christmas meditation and the prayer for peace. In German prisoner of war camps, British soldiers organized their own nine lessons and carols along the lines of the Cambridge service. The importance that the service gained during the Second World War was closely linked to the transformation of the Anglican Church in the 30s and 40s, which since then has been less perceived as a religious institution than as a symbol of Englishness and keeper of national tradition. The festival too was considered as the epitome of a national tradition harking back to the late Middle Ages. It enveloped this narrative in music, the performance of the liturgy, and the magnificent late Gothic church endowed it with an overwhelming visual aesthetic, and the radio broadcast made it accessible everywhere. In this way, not only the constructed, but or rather invented historical continuity, but also the elitist place was concealed, which King's College, Cambridge, held in British class society. It comes as no surprise that Eric Hobsbawm, who had studied at King's, prominently referred to the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols in his influential book, The Invention of Tradition. It is in this institutional context in which Rutter's carol compositions are situated. Carols and their communal singing at Christmas, whether in church, on the streets, or in one's own home, are a Victorian invention, as the British culture of Christmas anyway has its root in Victorian times. Christmas carols are regarded to be an essential part of a specifically English Christmas, even a, quote, key expression of Englishness, as one newspaper once put it, and this idea indeed lies at the heart of the more modern understanding of the Christmas carol. For Rutter, who substantially contributed to their popularity in the last decades, carols have three key features. First, the oscillation between popular music and art music. Second, their emphasis on melody and dance, simplicity and childishness. Third, their emotional power. Quote, they have all this extraordinary ability to just awaken happy memories. Somehow, hearing the music of Christmas brings back the magic and the mood of Christmas, he underlined. Hence, he seeks to evoke pleasant memories of childhood Christmas celebrations, of worry-free moments in an ordered world of family, community, and consumerism. No religious background is needed for this. In any case, the agnostic Rutter refrained from theologizing his works. The Christian texts and musical forms serve as memory snippets and hence blend perfectly in the secularized Christmas culture of our times. Nevertheless, Rutter's music can equally be adapted to a religious culture of Christmas, very much in line with his other sacred compositions. If at the end of the 20th century two cultures of Christmas had formed, a religious and a secular one, Rutter's music worked in both. His carols are suitable for liturgy and department store alike, and this makes them so popular. However, this is also in no small part due to Rutter's merchandising machine, which every year around Christmas serves the market with CDs and ever new variations, and for some years also with music files to download. With John Rutter's Christmas celebration taking place at the Royal Albert Hall in London every year, the composer also shares in the Christmas consumers and entertainment culture. A concert event with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by John Rutter himself, carol classics to sing along, a Christmas quiz, and an audience of 5,200 paying fans. Such carol concerts are an established part of the Christmas calendar in the UK, as you all might know. The nationalization of Christmas, which indeed was a global phenomenon in the 20th century and the 21st centuries, also became apparent in the stylizing of singing in the choir as a unique century-long national treasure. Quote, "These days Britain might not be much copied building stones and bridges, and it no longer seems able to run a health service or a railway system. But there are some things we can still do and that you feel obliquely proud to be part of. Producing choirs out of communities is one of them," the readers of the Daily Telegraph were told in 2000. Hence, decline was everywhere, but in the cultural realm, Britain would defend its global leadership position. A decade later, the same newspaper was not only still convinced that, quote, "British choirs lead the world," but also that the singing culture of the churches would provide the best way to retreat from the present economic and financial crisis. Quote, "Anyone who feels assaulted by the weight of economic doom should try an hour of Gibbon's Bird or Herbert Howells with a decent choir," or John Rutter, one could add. Music served as a basis of national identity. The interpreters of Rutter's Christmas music and of the culture that had evolved around the practice of music making used exactly these narratives. They would describe it as an expression of true timeless Englishness, as a culture of life around church, village, community and family, as a pastoral and rural idyll. The music was literally enveloped by this narrative. Not least, it was advanced by the composer when he presented himself as the simple musical craftsman from the English village. Journalists were only too pleased to take up this narrative, the more so as it confirmed American clichés of Britain. In 2017, for example, the New York Times reported from a trip to the village Rutter lives in, quote, "It is the sort of English village which you may find on Christmas cards, a medieval church, a placid river, thatched cottages, swans. So it's no great surprise that it is also where you can find John Rutter." These images and stories quote from an influential narrative of the nation which took hold from the 1920s and featured characteristic Englishness, mind you, not Britishness. It was both marked by the idea of the little man as guardian of the national character and a praise for the English rural landscape. Stanley Baldwin, Conservative Prime Minister of the interwar years, was as instrumental in creating it as was the left-wing author George Orwell. And it indeed was an integrative national narrative stretching party lines. Against this background, John Rutter's popularity can be interpreted as an expression of a new English nationalism that took hold at the millennium. It was fueled by the revolution, deindustrialization, migration, cultural globalization, and the populist style of politics. It took destructive effect in the British decision for Brexit. However, the new English recoding of the nation was not necessarily invested with this sort of politicization. That's important to understand. And Rutter's music certainly was not one of its drivers. Nevertheless, the notions of Englishness manifested in Rutter's music, which did not have a lot in common with the British realities of the recent past. Neither did it reflect the confrontational nature of the post-imperial, multicultural and multi-religious society of contemporary Britain, nor the dominant metropolitan culture, nor the social distortions of British neoliberalism. On the contrary, the Christmas culture that had evolved around Rutter's music invoked a white, Christian, well-ordered England of imperial grandeur, untouched by the challenges of modernity. It had a decidedly conservative tone. This tone reached far beyond the United Kingdom. The reception of Rutter's music in the US played into imaginations of a Christian Western tradition of Anglo-Saxon nations, the reception in Australia and Canada into those of the Anglosphere, which had become popular in conservative circles beginning in the 1990s. In a certain sense, Rutter's carols constituted the equivalent to the Christmas pop songs that entered the global musical repertoire, being products of the American music business. In his case, the transfer took place in the other direction, supported by the transatlantic music culture of popular classics, which was no lesser part of Western pop culture than rock, pop, or punk. Not every choir member who sang Rutter's music, me included, by the way, not every concert goer who descended into his sound worlds was conservative. It would be absurd to allege that. But anyone had the opportunity to adopt the conservative potentials of the music as an expression of an attitude to life, as an ingredient of a lifestyle, and also as a political symbol. Around the practices of making music or listening to music, cultures of conservatism could develop, which transferred the conservatism of the music into everyday life. When we look at the nationally so different ways of how Rutter's music was received, the complexity of the options available for its adoption and appropriation become apparent. While in Britain his music was charged with ideas of the nation and national community, in Germany it remained in the framework of sacred music for the church. Yet the conservative character of the music arched over all national differences. In the truest sense of the word, it was inscribed into the music. As an entrepreneur for himself, Rutter replicated the image of the successful individual, of the autonomous entrepreneurial economic actor, which was at the heart of neoliberal ideology. It was incessantly propagated by Thatcherism, not least in the realm of culture and the arts. Rutter was a musical entrepreneur as Thatcher could only have wished for. He personified the type of artist which Margaret Thatcher advocated for, without Rutter even ever positioning himself politically. He lived and still lives quite well from his art because it was attractive for a wide audience. He neither depended on art subsidies nor on state-run institutions. He made good at the market. The transatlantic music market was the key to his success, and he perfectly understood its logics. Rutter indeed made use of key developments that took hold from the 70s, the progressing transnationalization, commercialization, and consumer culturalization of classical music, the opportunities of digitalization and mass medialization. As unpolitical as Rutter's music appeared to be, as much was it positioned on the conservative side in terms of cultural policies. For in the music world, the cultural policies of Thatcherism corresponded with the critique of the compositional avant-garde. It opened the door to a form of musical conservatism which recurred to a specifically English tradition and focused on the popular, in opposition to an allegedly purely continental art music for a small elite whose representatives and patrons would hold the key positions in the Arts Council and the BBC. The state license for the radio station Classic FM, broadcasting from 1992 and specializing on popular classics, was directed against the programming policy of BBC Radio 3. Rutter owes his popularity not least to this competition. Up to our days, its attitude towards popular classics sparks conservative criticism of the BBC. Not surprisingly, in conservative journalism, John Rutter is used as an example of those classic stars allegedly banned from the BBC. And equally deplored in these circles is his neglect by musicology. This conservative politicization went hand in hand with the nationalization of the British choral and singing culture. It ensured and still ensures Rutter's success. Moreover, his rise to prominence took place against the backdrop of the religious transformation processes which took off in Europe and the US in the 60s, albeit in a virtually opposite direction. In Europe, Christianity gradually lost its dominant cultural and social position and had to find a new place in a both multi-religious and secular society. In the US, by contrast, a missionary evangelical Protestantism formed the political power that since the 70s has decisively shaped the politics of the Republican Party. Culturally, however, the religious transformation processes were highly ambiguous. On the one hand, they got their impulse from reformist movements, which demanded an opening of the churches to the world, hence pushed for a liberalization of theology and value systems. On the other hand, they were designed as an alternative to social liberalization, which was understood as rallying cry against the good order of society and the living tradition. Rutter's music combined both trends. It integrated new trends by opening up to the popular and by reforming the sound worlds of sacred music culture. At the same time, it adhered to the classic European tradition and defended it against both the avant-garde and pop music alike. It was equally embedded in pop and consumer culture and the world of church music. It represented a conservative style which sounded modern at the same time. To read Rutter's music as a simple counter-movement against the liberalization of culture and society, therefore, falls short of an interpretation. Rather, he was part of the conservative new beginnings in the midst of the cultural transformation which got hold of the Western industrial societies in the 60s and laid the ground for political conservatism to unfold. Cultures of conservatism were an expression of the search for new order in a time when established certainties were shattered, the familiar idea of progress called into question, and the new beginnings of the 50s and 60s had become history. They were part of the age of fracture, to refer to the American historian Daniel T. Rogers' well-known interpretation. The example of John Rutter also calls attention to pop culture as a defining strand of the late 20th century. It was obviously not only progressive, and it did not only embrace youth cultures. Also, the example aptly illustrates the significance of pop culture for the transnationalization of conservatism since the 70s. Pop culture was quintessentially commercialized, and hence, merely because of the logics of the market, it was politically open. This contributed decisively to creating possibilities for conservative adaptations. It also conformed to the forms of social community formation produced by the culture industries. In many cases, there were certainly no more than, quote, loose and transitory solidarities, as Andreas Gestrich and Christiane Eisenberg argue, but the success of John Rutter's choral music and the church milieus are proof enough that they could also have a community-building effect. Admittedly, the social worlds of conservatism crumbled down in the 60s, as Lawrence Black has convincingly shown in his study on the British young conservatives and as German research on the bourgeoisie indicates, but new conservative worlds began to establish themselves. Popular music by no means contributed to the leveling of social differences and hierarchies, and it also did not lead to a general depoliticization. It is this process that research will have to scrutinize in the time to come. The pop culture dominance of British and US American artists and their works corresponded to the political and intellectual influence of a renewed Anglo-American conservatism of the likes of Reagan and Thatcher. pop cultures established transatlantic spaces of shared culture, which could be interpreted in a conservative manner. It pushed the transnationalization of conservatism forward. Rutter's innocent Christmas carols, therefore, far transcend the sound worlds of English cathedrals and parish churches. On the one hand, John Rutter is indeed a very English superstar. On the other, he is not, but the highly successful actor of a culturally transmitted transnational conservatism. Thank you very much for your attendance.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.